TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
From the New School in New York City, the People's Climate Week Launch, Part 3. The Indigenous Environmental Network, IEN, brought members of the Black Hive to a teach-in at the New School to address toxic sites in Texas and the ongoing Flint water crisis. You will hear from Natalie Jeffers, director of the Black Hive, Marsha Jackson, and Mr. Alan McGill from Dallas County, Texas, Naira from Flint, Michigan, and Aya De Leon, novelist and activist. This is the last of a three-part program bringing you the rarely heard voices from that four-hour event. You heard in part one from indigenous grassroots opposition to pipelines, geoengineering, hydrogen production, carbon capture, and sequestration. On the second program, you heard about resistance to U.S. military bases on the Mariana Islands, and speakers from Puerto Rico and Pakistan gave facts about Superfund pollution sites from U.S. military actions and the environmental destruction caused by multinational corporations. This closing session is hosted by Natalie Jeffers, director of the Black Hive, recorded on September 19 at the New School, New York City.
Greetings, peace, love, and solidarity, friends, family, and comrades. How are you all feeling? Thank you so much for your time, for choosing to be here. We've brought in a lot of knowledge into this space today, and we're kind of digesting it. So I'm honored to be here with you all and to be in alliance with this phenomenal group of Black Indigenous people of color who are doing climate environmental justice work. So much work and strategy and thought and community and building went into creating this space. So I just want to hold for a moment to say thank you for all the labor. Thank you to the labor of everybody who works in this building behind the scenes, and making sure we're all safe. My name is Natalie Jeffers, and I have the honor and the blessing of leading the Black Hive. The Black Hive. The Black Hive is a home for all Black and climate environmental justice leaders. At the moment, about 150 of us come together regularly, and we use our collective experience, skills, knowledge to create real solutions to the climate crisis and the ecological destruction that is impacting Black communities in the US, across the global Black diaspora, and Africa. The Black Hive, we put Black liberation at the center of our fight for the global climate environmental justice. The Black Hive, we use organizing, policy, narrative power. We create culture, everyday accessible education, resiliency, and solidarity to catalyze Black communities to take action and build solutions in the face of this climate crisis. We believe that all our communities deserve self-determination in all decisions that impact our lives, our futures, and our safety. At present, the climate and environmental policy solutions on the global government's tables are beyond insufficient. They are killing us. We know, after hearing from all of these beautiful, powerful human rights and environmental defenders and protectors of our planet, that our governments and corporations do not and will not protect our people. The people who are suffering from historical and ongoing pollution, nor are their false solutions sufficient to meet in any targets which are needed to ensure that Mother Earth will be fit for human habitation beyond 2030. We are in a crisis. We will no longer accept climate environmental policies that do not center the health and well-being of Black, Indigenous, and Brown peoples. We will no longer accept policies that sacrifice our communities and the environments we live in. The Black Hive, we have created a Black climate mandate in response. Our mandate calls for the dismantling of the status quo and the shifting of resources into transformative strategies that protects and empowers the most marginalized in society. The Black Hive, our work and our mandate focuses on water, energy, land, labor, economy, reparations, democracy, health, and global Black diasporic solidarity. We believe that all of these connect, and it's that intersectionality, that point where everything comes together, that we have some of the deepest burdens and the greatest solutions. We are organizing and nurturing brilliant, bold Black climate and environmental justice leadership across generations. We have youth, we have elders, and we have people who are here to hold, heal, and support all Black lives to thrive in the face of climate change. And we know we have the solutions, right? We've heard it, we've seen the people, the leadership is here. We have the solutions that come from thousands of years of our Indigenous communities all across this planet. So thank you. We are now, I'm going to have such honor to introduce you to some of our community frontline organizers in the Black Hive who are going to speak to their work and some of the real solutions that they're building in their communities. So first of all, it's a great honor to introduce Miss Marsha and Mr. Allen from Southern Sector Rising, and they're going to talk for a few minutes about their work. Give them a round of applause, y'all.
Thank you. My name is Marsha Jackson. I'm of Dallas, Texas. My organization is Southern Sector Rising, and we are an environmental and justice organization. We started because it's a Black and brown community where you know that 180,000 tons of roofing shingles will not be placed in a white community. There we are. We have been harmed. I have been harmed permanently. My vocal cords are permanently damaged. And as you continue to hear me speaking, you can hear my voice start fading away. So my community also was harmed because you know whenever you fight the city, whenever you fight the elected officials, you know you're going to receive retaliation. I was selected as a spokesperson for my community. Therefore, you see my face and you might not see my brown community, but I am the voice. They're my family and I'm going to speak for them continually. And I not only started with my community because we had to fight, we had to march just as we did this weekend. We had to even stand and do mock trials in front of elected officials. And that's what you'll see, that's what's going to happen with organizers. We continue doing this. We're going to continue doing this because I tell people all the time, maybe they left that pollution there so my voice can permanently go away. But I tell people all the time, as long as we have sign language, you're going to hear my voice. So we continue fighting that, not only in my community, it started locally, but we end up going nationally because everybody needs help, we need support. So now we're also working with our Sand Branch community, and I'll let Alan explain more of that, because here we are now still in 2023, we have community, Black community, that has no running water. So we're gonna have to continue fighting for that. Just as I said, that 180,000 tons of roofing shingles are near my home. We had to continue fighting for that almost 5 years, but it was moved. We still have remediation that we just successfully gained that remediation last week. So $2.5 million from that city is now moving those roofing shingles. And we're going to continue cleaning that property, but that wasn't going to shut our mouths. So we all still have work to do. We're in here in this fight to help each other, so we're going to continue fighting that as well.
Thank you, Marsha, and good afternoon to all of our sisters and brothers who come to join us this afternoon. I'm to talk a little bit about a community called Sand Branch, located about 14 miles southeast of Dallas, Texas. Marsha mentioned in her remarks about one of the amenities that we all mostly here in this audience take for granted, the availability of running water, sewage, sidewalks, garbage collection, and other social services and physical infrastructure that we just take for granted. Sand Branch residents which are, well, let me describe it this way. Sand Branch is a freedman town. Freedman towns were settled by enslaved people. Sand Branch is the only unincorporated space in northern Texas that has not been annexed by a city. Sand Branch does not have running water, sewage collection. It does not have sidewalks, street lights, nicely paved roads, streets. Sand Branch is at the intersection of what we call environmental justice, civil rights, and a sacrifice zone. It's the end result of capitalism at its worst. Sand Branch, part of this community, is located in a flood zone. The main relocation tool for getting people to move from this area, because it's an important spot for developers. They want the land. The relocation tool of choice is suspected arson. Just a few weeks ago, Marsha and I, and we visit Sand Branch often, the community center burned to the ground. As I was kicking through the rubble, there was a pile of records partially burned. One of them was of a family. It was their intake document. And it said, August 1st, 1996, Miss So-and-so with three kids, total income for the year, $3,200. So we invite you to remember the sacrifice that enslaved people have put into this country. We did not ask to come here. We don't want to be here. But we are here and being exploited by a system that we have very little influence on. All of this is upheld under a platform of racism that is so insidious as to be without words or description. But here sits what can happen. Local leadership, a new organization, new energy, bringing momentum to correct all of these injustices and sacrifice zones like Sand Branch.
Yes, yes, yes. We give it up for Miss Marsha and Mr. Allen. Woo. Yes, yes, thank you. They've been out on these front lines for decades and are helping to support in our youth, and we have an intergenerational and youth elder council and exchange to be learning together and sharing knowledge. So thank you for your work and your sacrifice. Next up, you ready for more? Okay, so we have Naira, a dear, dear comrade who's been fighting on the front lines of the water struggle in their city. So Naira, thank you so much for your time, fam. Tell him some stuff.
I'm gonna tell you where I'm from. Peace, y'all. So I'm from Flint, Michigan, which is the birthplace of a lot of things, the birthplace of struggle. In 1936, 1937, you had a group of auto workers who occupied a plant and went after the largest corporation in the world and won, which is the UAW. And shout out to the striking workers right now at the UAW and the Writers Guild of America and the Screen Actors Guild, because we need labor in this fight. And one of the things that I learned before I start talking about Flint Rising, just growing up, what solidarity looks like. Because we all we got. We are the only ones that we got with each other. So I grew up taking care of each other, taking care of my community. And, you know, the Flint water crisis, which, you know, had another story that was told about Flint, the fact that 100,000 people could be poisoned within the United States and with no consequences because no one has been criminally charged with that. Also, the fact that a whole community could be basically sold to sell bonds and didn't care if people had like clean running water. And the fact that, you know, water could be commodified, like something that is essential to life could be commodified, and people being punished for not having running water, because in, you know, Michigan is one of many states that if you don't have running water, Child Protective Services can come and remove your children from the home, and now they're locked up in the foster care system. If you don't have running water, the outstanding water bill could be put on your homes for a tax lien, and you can lose your home, you know, through the tax foreclosure process. And so all those things we learned when we went to the switch to the Flint River, because that is so Flint Rising was really born in the aftermath of the emergency declarations, because when we got like the emergency declaration, we then realized that, you know, the Flint water crisis, you know, wouldn't be eligible under the Federal Stafford Act because it was caused by people. It was not an act of God. So we did not get like those type of resources. And we had like the state who was responsible for poisoning us, responsible for the recovery. And, you know, like, I don't know if I can cuss on stage, but they was like mad up and like using like this as they always do. It's a common tactic that they weaponize the recovery to go after folks. And they was, you know, doing ICE raids because people couldn't get water because they were required to show a photo ID to get water. And then, like, they were also serving warrants, and they had people on work release doing all that crap. And so that's why Flint Rising was born, because we were like, we need to have a space that's a non-barrier way for people to get water. We need to do like this education, like basically doing the state's job for them, not the pay that we get. And so like through the years, you know, we continued that practice of solidarity. So every community, fortunately or unfortunately, every community you've heard of in the news that had a lead and water crisis, like we've been there working with residents and telling them our theory of change and all of the things that people should be looking out for, from like developing like model ordinances, like developing model contracts to recruit workers and making sure that through the vendor system that people can make a living wage, to attacking like the water policy and ensuring that water infrastructure doesn't remain like how it is right now, which is structurally racist, because there's through 40 plus years of federal disinvestment, like they've moved on to the stock market. They've moved on to municipal bonds to try to raise the funds. And because majority, like communities of color, they do not have the bond rating like white communities, because it's structurally racist. We know what it is. And so like that's like one of the many things that we are doing as far as working on water policy and water affordability. And I could do a whole TED talk on municipal bonds and how they're trash. But that is like, you can meet me in the lobby over some pizza and we could talk about that. But I want to end, you know, like one of, I would say like, you know, this, a trade union thing. I'm gonna kind of adapt it. It's called Solidarity Forever. Like, y'all probably know it if y'all study movement history and like labor history. So I'm just gonna end like with the thing is like solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, because the people make us strong. Thank you.
Ooh, can we get some love for Naira? Thank you, thank you. Like I say, this is just a little aperitif, a little starter. You can get into more conversations with us. So finally, I want to bring up a dear comrade, an amazing climate fiction author, Aya de Leon.
Thank you. All right. So what is the story that we're telling about this movement? At the Black Hive, we look to our ancestors for guidance and inspiration. And lately, we've been thinking about the author, Octavia Butler. And here, yes, we've got some folks who know. And here's, if you don't know, or if you do, here's a quote from her. Quote, kindness eases change, love quiets fear, and a sweet and powerful obsession blunts pain, diverts rage, and engages each of us in the most intense of our chosen struggles, unquote. For Octavia Butler, 2023 also marks the 30th anniversary of her prophetic novel, Parable of the Sower. 3 decades ago, she looked at the scientific evidence about global warming and imagined a world in 2024 in climate crisis, but also in crises of income inequality, racism, and an authoritarian president with the slogan, Make America Great Again. Octavia Butler envisioned this novel as the first in a series that would end with climate solutions. However, she made many frustrated attempts and never finished the series. Octavia Butler passed away in 2006, but we at the Black Hive want to continue her legacy, not by writing a novel, but we want to live the story of manifesting the climate solutions we know are possible. Yes. We want to live the story of the people coming together, rising up and building the mass movement that has the power to put an end to fossil fuels, to create a livable future on our planet, and to repair the harm to the people and the planet from this crisis and the interlocking oppressive systems that got us here. We call this the parable of the movement. We want our movement, yes, we want our movement to become Octavia Butler's final book, the story in which we fight and we win. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. I want to thank Miss Marsha, Mr. Alan McGill, Nayira. I'm going to say her name wrong. You're going to correct me later. Nayira and Aya for the words and the poem, but thank you for all of your words. So I want to just like share like a little bit about this journey that we've been on this afternoon, this evening, wherever we're at right now. We heard, you know, about the impacts of militarism on our communities, what that's meant for the land and for our bodies, and what war has, how it's impacted our people. And how it's impacted and contributed to climate change, like in huge, big ways. And yet, you know, we have companies all the time saying, oh, everybody's individual share, when we're not even counting how much the military is contributing. We heard about what we need to do, what our responsibility is as those folks who live in the belly of the beast, this US imperial state that we live in. Right? We have a responsibility to also understand the impacts that is happening in the global South and our relationship to the relatives there, and how do we build those relationships and hold them both in their struggles and understanding that who they're fighting against are usually corporations that originate from here in the US. And we also heard about like the just transition. What can that look like? We heard so many stories about just transition. what that can be and what it isn't, right? Just transition isn't about false solutions. Just transition is about what we want to see in our communities and how do we get there in a way that our communities don't get harmed again in the process. But that we have to start with stopping it at its source. Leave it in the ground, right? And we heard a lot more stories too. The Black climate mandate, there's a lot in there that is universal to all of our communities. And what is there, the stepping stones of what that mandate can be, not only as opportunities for our community, but a pathway and a to-do list. There was a list of demands as well as a to-do list of what we should be holding our elected officials accountable for and what we should be holding corporations accountable. And how do we pull apart that relationship and hold and chokehold that corporations have on our political system, right? These are the stories that we heard, but it's also our responsibility. I heard much of that call out and a call also to just help, you know, the stories that we heard at the beginning from Texas and from the Mountain Valley Pipeline. Like, we need your help. We need you to understand what we're dealing with and the support that we're needing. And we want to share in the strategies and share what's happening. So I thank all of our speakers here. I thank all of our speakers for sharing that with us. And we're about to go into some space to strategize a little bit more about that. And I'm passing it on.
Thank you, Kasamang Bineshi.
We've been on a journey. We've been on a like fast journey this evening and the last couple of days. Today we came together and kind of like tried to give each other support and rally support with each other, shared some more stories of what is possible and what we want to see happen. And this is, should not be the end conversation for any of y'all. But I want to just thank everyone for your patience and diligence and commitment to be here, your commitment to connect with others, your commitment to strategize, and your commitment to dream and live what is possible for all of us, for that world that we want, like that good life that we want to have, that good life that is being stolen from us. We still have the power to make that. And I love and appreciate you all for being here because I see you guys are carrying that vision and we're all going to carry it out with each other from here.
That was the moderator of the event for the People's Climate Week launch, sponsored by the Indigenous Environmental Network, IEN. They met for almost 4 hours in the auditorium of the New School in New York City on September 19, 2023. The IEN is now preparing to raise the demand to end the use of fossil fuels without delay at the upcoming United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP28. To stay up to date, check the Indigenous Environmental Network at ienearth.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.